Thanks, Erin, for that very generous introduction. Thank you for joining me today. It's very lovely to have to be able to give this opportunity to share with you one strand of my work and looking at how language could affect thinking. And I just want to say from the very start that there is, even within this one strand, there's basically two big camps. And I'm going to talk about one of the camps because there's not enough time to talk about both. Okay, so let's get started. It's very difficult for us to imagine how we would be without language. This talk will never happen. We'll never know each other. It's very difficult for us to interact. At the very least, we'll be very inefficient, if not impossible, if we don't have language. And the question that I think is really bugging us, or very important, and this is not my own questions. Philosophers have been struggling with these questions for a very long time. Psychologists really like this question as well. Is the question, is there mind without language? Is there something in your head? Can you think about something if you don't have language? Okay. Well, I would like to ask these questions together with you and tell you a little bit about the answer to this question. But let's step back for a moment and think about what is language, right? Most of you would probably think that, well, language is a means of communication. And you are absolutely correct. Language is a means of communication. But that's not all of it. In fact, if language is only a means of communication, that's not unique to us. What's unique about language is that it's a symbol system. Lots of animals communicate with each other, and they have their means to do that. But what's really interesting and what's really fascinating about human language is that a symbol system. Now, let me unpack a little bit what we mean by a symbol system. Well, first thing is that language has symbols for things. When you look at this picture, you will call this dog in English. And if you just stop by for a moment and think about it, there is no way you could actually figure out the meaning of dog from truly your sensory experience, right? And so what we say about why we label this thing dog is arbitrary. The symbol is arbitrary, and that's actually very important. So the symbol is arbitrary. Let me illustrate it with a couple of other languages. In Indonesian, this is called anjing. So it sounds, looks very different from dog. And again, it's because it's arbitrary symbol. It doesn't conform to your sensory experience. You will never figure out the meaning of it unless you're actually told about it or you learn about it. So that's arbitrary. In Polish, it will be called pies. So again, look very different. So these symbols are arbitrary, and any symbol can stand for any meaning. But of course, it doesn't come for free. We have to agree on what symbol we use for what, right? People can, you know, go even have a death life battles about what symbols do you want to use for a particular concept. More importantly, it's also governed by a system. I said one of the systems that govern it, it's conventionalized, right? If one of you suddenly say that this is cat, you will be shunned by your colleagues. Okay? So that's one of the systems that's governing it. It's also governed by a system that we all know to use it correctly. So if I show you two of these things, in English you have to say there are two dogs. In Indonesian, you don't change anything. You just say the word anjing, you say the word two, but the word anjing on itself doesn't change. So the system, it's governed by the system is different. Okay. In Polish, you actually have to change the word itself. So when you say two dogs, you say są dwa psy. And so the word pies actually changed. Polish does give you headache. If you say five dogs, it changed again. Yes, pięć psów. And then you say there are no dogs, it also changed again. Nie ma psa. Okay. So the noun itself is conjugated, so it's actually, there are differences, it takes different forms. So this is just to illustrate that language is arbitrary symbols that's governed by a system. And this is a system of language that we're going to look at today in answering our question, is there mind without language. And what do we mean by this question? By this question is we're asking, do they have, when you look at babies, you ask the questions, do they have enduring thoughts as opposed to reacting to senses all the times? Is it all the time sensory reactions to what comes, light, smile, sound, or is there a thought that's in the mind about what is that light could mean, what is that smile could mean? Okay. In other words, we also want to ask the question, is it a state of blooming, buzzing confusion, as the father of psychology, William James, famously said in his book in 1890, that for infants, it's always a state of blooming, buzzing confusion. Okay. If you have a nagging feeling that you actually have seen this baby before, you are correct, because the father of this baby is here. This is Eli this is Eli Grotner, Dan's son. All right, he's bigger now, and even cuter. All right, so let's ask ourselves, how do we find out, Joe? Because we can just ask them. Babies cannot answer. They wouldn't understand, right? So we need clever ways to find out, is their mind with language? Are there enduring thoughts? Or are the state of the baby's mind is always a blooming, buzzing confusion? Okay? So we need to make use of what babies can do. And one thing that they're really good at is they're really good at looking. Okay? They're pretty much, if you have babies, and a lot of you probably have, you probably realize they're not much things can do. They can cry, they can suck their pacifiers, and they can look. And you probably forgot about this looking aspect because it happens all the time. But for psychologists, for developmental psychologists, this has been really exploited. This gives us a really, really good means to ask the question to find out whether there is a mind without language. Okay? Because they don't have language yet at this point. At least they're not speaking. Okay? They hear language all the time. Okay. So to find out about the mind, we are going to make use of looking. And the looking experiment has a simple yet elegant logic. So I want to go through this logic together with you so we got a sense about how can we really be sure the answer to our questions, whether there's a mind without language. It's not just freely looking, however, because let's say I ask you to look at these two. Where do you want to look at? You're going to shrug your shoulders and say, I don't care. It's just the same, interesting the same. Or some of you may say, well, I have cats at home, so I prefer to look at the cats, or I'm bored with the cats. But it's going to be all over the place, right? You have no idea where you should look. You're not going to care. And presumably, this is going to be the same with the human infants. However, if I first show you this series of pictures, I show you this dog, this dog, this dog, this dog, and this dog, then you probably now have a preference where you want to look at between these two. Okay? Some of you will, so after I habituate you to this series of pictures, some of you in the test may say that, like, ooh, there's something new, and I want to prefer to look at this something new. Some of you who prefer to look at the old stuff probably will look at this one as well. It doesn't matter where you look at, but what we're really interested in about, or what the logic of this experiment is, that in order for you to be able to look, to say that this is new, or to say that this is old, you have to know something about these things, right? You have to say that these are dogs. Yeah? There's no way you can use your sensory experience to find out that this is old. Why? Because notice that this very dog doesn't actually show up here. Okay? So if you just match based on how it looks, you're not gonna be able to say new versus old. In essence, both of these, in terms of being pictures, they are new pictures. But in terms of being concept and categories, this is the old concept, or same as the habituation, and this is the new concept. I also purposefully choose a picture of a cat and a dog that has very similar in color. And in fact, if you just go by how it looks, this color of the fur is more similar to this color of the fur. So that's the logic of the experiment. We show habituation trials to look at, to probe at a particular concept. So in this case, we want to ask, do infants know something about cats? Or do infants know something about dogs and infants? And then we gave them, we gave them two test trials. Both of them are new, one coming from the old concept and one coming from the new concept. Okay? And if they differentiate, if they look longer to the new ones or to the old ones consistently, then that tells us that they have something in their mind that organizes these things, all these things into a single concept. At least that's what I mean. In the lab, it usually looks like this, that there is an infant seated on the mom's lap, and the infants will be watching a video. So this is during the test trials. This is actually a test from Lisa Oak's lab, where she actually asking whether how detailed do infants know about properties of cats and properties of dogs, because they both have four legs and fur and so on. And behind the screen, so the babies and the moms cannot see this person over here, you code the looking time, whether the infant looks to the left or to the right, and you'll be able to tell where do they look longer. Okay. So let me pause for a moment and also invite you, if there's anything that is unclear, please let me know and ask me questions as I go along. Okay. Is the logic of this looking time experiment pretty clear? Okay. Yeah, question. Yeah, that's going to screw up the experiment. No, for sure. Because then if you get, so you do want to get consistency from your participants. And this is something that actually we deal a lot. This is one difficulty that we deal a lot, because we can't predict in particular whether the infants before is going to prefer to look at new things or to look at old things. General rules of thumb is that usually the young infants prefer to look at familiar stuff. Whereas the old, slightly older infants, 6 months old later, they usually prefer to look at new stuff. But this is actually much of a debate within the community about how you even can predict this before the experiment. And it's actually very interesting. There's a lot of interesting implications about what's the state of the cognitions, about whether you prefer old or new, or if you prefer none of those. Okay. Yeah, we'll not get results if you prefer variations. So that's an example. I just give you an example of using looking time experiment when asking a concept like, do you know what cat is, okay, as opposed to dogs. Right. I'm going to show you a different one. So here's in this experiment, my colleagues and I asked the questions, do you have a concept about amount of stuff that you look at in this world? Do you know that whether the soup that is in your cup is more or less than the soup in the person's cups next to you? Okay. So that's the question that we ask in terms of our concept. Now you're familiar with this notion habituation trials. We first have to habituate them to a certain event, and this is the event that we're habituating them. There is a hand that's pick up a cup, and the hand pour the cup onto the white plate, and then the hand goes back. Okay. So we do the habituation trials over and over again with the same amount of sand. So this is actually one teaspoon of sand, of blue sand that we're pouring over and over again. Now, because this is a live experiment, we did this live, over the time, over the many habituation trials, we actually varies about how much these blue sand cover the white cup, how spread out it is, and so on. Because what we're really interested about is do infants actually see the amount itself and not the shape covering the plate. So what do we do during test trials? So again, test trials, the logic is there is old, so this one is old, and there is a new one. So here's old amount, a new amount. Okay, this is the same amount as before. And our question is, do infants actually look differently between this old amount and new amount? We did this with 7 months old, and here's how it looks like in the habituation trials. So remember I said that we measured their looking time. So this is habituation trials 1, 2, 3, and the last three habituation trials. And what you can see here that the looking time of the infants decrease. Yeah. Sometimes you may hear that the babies are bored. That's what really is. Like, we try to bore them If they stay constant, then it's difficult for us to ask, hey, do you see something new or do you see something old, right? So we first have to bore them. So the looking time decrease, and then we take a look at the test. Here's the novel average over a couple of trials, and here's the familiar. And what you can see here, in this case, in this experiment, the infants actually prefer to look longer to the novel amount, right? And because the infants prefer to look longer to the novel amounts, and because we actually vary how much the sand covers the white plate, and these are exactly the same white plate between here, what we conclude from here is the infants have some kinds of quantity discrimination with mass things like sand at 7 months old. We did this with 3 months olds, and they showed interesting. They are able to distinguish it, but only when the habituation is with large amounts. Somehow there's that allows them to be able to know that things better. Okay, so those just are very 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 short two snippets of what we can do to ask the questions. Is there a mind without language? And the answer is a resounding yes. It's definitely not a state of blooming, buzzing confusion. We know this. Decades of work by psychologists, developmental psychologists, have shown us that infants know a lot of things. So they know folk physics. They, like you, know that objects persist over time and space. If you show them magic, that the object disappeared when they come into another object, infants will be very surprised. They will look longer. They also know that unsupported objects fall to the ground. They understand gravity, that maybe not have a head, like a conscious notion about what gravity is, but if they see an object hanging in the air, they also look very surprised. So here's some example from folk biology. They expect animals, but not artifacts, to actually have insights. So they have some sense that if an animal, and they know animals from a self-movement, an agentive movement, they expect that these things to actually have insights, even if it looks like a can. So a can that moves by itself and say quack, quack, the infants will be very surprised if you turn around the can and show that the can is hollow, because they expect that animals should have something inside. They also have notions about how a psychological they have notions of psychology, so they also expect that agent has a goal and not just mere physical movements. So for example, if they see a hand reaching over here, instead of just encoding this event as simply hand going to the left space, hand or simply hand going up and going up, they will actually encode this as a goal-directed movement if it's done by an agent. So the hand wants a teddy bear. So if I switch the teddy bear to and the ball in terms of space, and the hand continues to go to the same space, they'll be very surprised, because the infants expect that the hand wants the teddy bear and not just going to the same space. So encoding of the actions is also goal directed. There are numerous categories that infants already know by this point. They know things about numerosity. So these are just snippets about what infants know without language. So, these are varies. Some of them are like, I don't give the exact things here, but there's some, by 6 months old, you definitely know about the gravity. The expectation about folk biology comes the earliest we know is at 8 months old, on the various ones here. Some of the objects doesn't pass each other, we know that by 3 months old, they already expect that. So there's a variation as well. And that's a really important question. So I know that I make a sweeping comment that infants know about this, but it also depends on their age, obviously. Okay. So then we may ask, if infants already know so much, okay, then what is language good for, right? They already have this good notion, and it's not a state of blooming, buzzing confusion. What is the role of language here? Well, you may say, well, the language can make you communicate very easily. Lots of you parents are really excited when you hear first words from your children, okay? Because you can finally find out what is it that they're thinking or what is it they're doing. And it's great. But remember that we said that what's really unique about human language is not only that it's a means of communication, but it's a symbol system. So for the rest of the talk, what I would like to ask together with you is that what does one get from acquiring a symbol system, a highly developed symbol system as language is? So not only that you can communicate, but beyond that, what do you get from acquiring a symbol system? Now, to ask this question, I actually would like to jump ahead. And so what I would like to argue is language is a cognitive tool. And we're going to see this in a moment. What do I mean by this? But I would like to jump ahead and do things that you can do, but not babies. So, because now you know that babies can do a lot of things, so I want to restore your confidence a little bit that you do know more than babies, OK? All right. So. Please answer this. Please complete this sentence. Walcorp divested itself of Best Tires and bought a more profitable tire company. Likewise, Marta divorced George, and what would Marta do? It's precisely what you should not do, Barry. Does anyone care or shout out what Marta would do? She married a more desirable husband, absolutely. That's probably most of you will do this, right? And she then married a more advantageous man, okay? Now, this doesn't come solely from knowing, so having a communication. Because notice, what is it that you do not do? You don't say that she bought a tire company, except Barry, because Barry is here to spoil my talk. you also don't just say that she just married someone. You particularly said, if you got it right, you particularly said that she married a more advantageous man. So what you are doing, what you just did, is you perceive the relational similarity. Okay? You notice that there is a relations between Walcorp and divesting Best Tires, and you do an inference of the same relation to Marta divorcing George, and throw a new inference that Marta is going to get a more profitable husband. Okay? Perceiving relational similarity is the essence of what we do all the time, from quotidian things to very sophisticated things, what's called analogical reasoning. So the essence of analogical reasoning is you are able to see patterns, relations, the similarity of patterns and relation across events, in this case, across the events of Walcorp and Best Tires and Marta and George events. Okay. Analogy pervades our life. Perceiving relational similarity pervades our life from things that are very mundane, like metaphors. When you think about fishing for compliments, you understand this meaning right away, and you're not thinking about the fish or the smell of the sea, you're thinking about the relations of what fishing means, right? That you bait it, right? And you actually look for it, and it may be hard to get it. So all these things you get from understanding the relations between actual fishing and fishing for compliments. You understand simile, life is like a box of chocolate, again, from noticing relational pattern, from noticing relational similarity. And you use this all the time, so you don't even think about it, but that's what the cognitive process is that has to happen before you can understand this. Although these days, my students kind of say, these days you never get a box of chocolate that you don't know what's inside, right? So the simile is about to die, I think. You use analogy for teaching a lot, probably. This is just a classic one from physics, high school, I think. that you use the analogy of something that you understand very well, the relations, the relational pattern of fluid flow, of water flow, to understand electrical flow. Okay? So you use analogy for teaching a lot. And many of you probably use analogy for your teaching. Please send them to me. I love collecting analogies. They're really great. Analogy and creativity has been talked a lot about how the link that having good analogical reasonings breeds a lot of creativity. And obviously, in scientific discovery, analogy becomes something that's really important. Konrad Lorenz, in his Nobel Lecture Prize in 1974, the title of his lecture is Analogy as a Source of Knowledge, because he felt that all his works, all his scientific discovery comes from analogically thinking about the relational patterns across the animals that he studied. Okay. In IQ tests like Raven's progressive matrices, some of you in education is probably familiar with this. You've seen this in IQ tests in your children in primary school. This, essentially, what you're doing here is that you need to understand the relational pattern that happens on the first row and the second row in order for you to be able to complete this answer. So in IQ tests, you also use this a lot. Okay. So I want to ask the questions then, if language as a symbol system is a good cognitive tool, then how does this cognitive tool help us with our analogical reasoning? Then give you three simple examples about this. The first one that I want to argue is that when you have words, when you have those symbols, when you name things, it gives you accessibility and stability. What do I mean by this? Is that the concept that you name, that relational pattern that you name, you suddenly say it's symmetry. The relational pattern that you name is more likely to be retained and accessed in the future. Much like from this drawer into this drawer, you can find your socks more easily. This is not my sock drawer. My sock drawer is more like that. But I would love to have my sock drawer like that. And when I see this, I think about language. And I think that's what one of the things that language is doing. It really makes it very neatly compartmentalized, such that it's more likely for you to retain it, to know that, well, there are actually pink socks in my drawer, okay? And you can access it in the future. It's much easier for you to access in the future. And that's a metaphor that we're really thinking about what the language does to our mind. If you put it in a gift box, it's maybe even easier for you to carry. And here's an example. When we show this picture to four-year-olds, and then we ask them, hey, look at these two pictures. You know what, you see these two pictures? And they're very excited about this. And we ask them, which of these two pictures is the match for these pictures? Which one would you choose? Thank you, Summer. Well, I think hopefully most of you choose the left one, right? Because you see the pattern. But 98% of the four-year-olds actually chose this one. Why? Because they see that there is a match between this and this, and they overlook the pattern completely. Okay? Not that this is wrong, but as we say, if you don't understand the pattern, if you don't see a relational similarity, it might impede your analogical reasoning. Okay? But if you have a word for it, and probably this is why you can so quickly go zoom in to the relational pattern, is because you're thinking about symmetry. So you have the word for it, and the naming of the pattern makes it a lot more accessible for you to go for it. If you have the name, it actually can serve as a higher order preposition, essentially as a building blocks. So you can choose to build these things from drawing the circle, the dot, and the dot and the lines one each of the time. But you probably wouldn't do that. You're probably going to connect all the triangles, and that's make you a lot faster. And that's what's happened as well when you actually have a label for a relational schema. So if you look at this sentence that I just picked randomly from a New York Times book review, the economic adversity caused by droughts or floods far exceeds the direct impact on the food supply. Now, you have no trouble understanding this sentence, but let me just remind you for a moment, there's so much efficiency that is actually being portrayed by all these words that are relational words, called relational nouns. Think about adversity, cause, droughts, floods, exceeds, impact. All those are relational patterns that are neatly encapsulated by the word. You don't have to go through from the very beginning again to explain what does cause even mean, okay? Or what does drought like mean. Okay. The second way that language can augment analogical reasoning is that language can invite abstraction. And I want to illustrate this by showing you a very simple task. A lot of these tasks are simple because we're doing it with young children. Where we do with this task is we show this picture and we say, see this one? And we ask them which of these two is a matching task again, which of these two matches this one? And this one is really simple. Unlike the previous one, there's nothing that should be distracting you. And yet, the 2 and 3-year-olds chose at random. Here, there's only one correct answer, right? The match should be this one. This thing doesn't match this in any way. Okay? They chose at random. Okay? And here's an example of like a kid showing at random. But then something magical happens if I actually change and say, look, this one is called a truffet. Okay. Now, when they actually hear the word truffet, they actually chose the same relation. So this is moved by itself. they actually choose the same relation here. So now they are correct, the same 2 and 3 year olds. Okay. And the language can do something really magical here. What is happening? Well, I think what's happening is that they actually think that truffet, even though they don't know what truffet is, we never tell them what is truffet. Truffet is just something that they hear. It's a novel word. But what they think, something that what's happening here, that know that truffet, things that are called the same name must mean the same thing. And if they think that truffet means the same thing across these, they're actually starting to look for the comparison, and they actually look for, and they'll be able to abstract what is the same between all these three, so I can call them truffet. And it happens to be nothing is about the object is the same, it's about the relation. The third way that language can augment analogical reasoning is in language there is structure. And the structure in language can also invite structure in your mind, structure in your concept. So here's another task. This is a hiding and finding game and hide and seek game that children really, that we did with 3 year olds and 4 year olds. And they really loved this game. So what they had to do in this game is really easy. There's a star, and then I said, oh, look where I'm hiding this star, okay? And now, and I said, now you close your eyes, and I'm gonna hide the star at the same place over here. And you have to find the star at the same place. If you find the star, you're gonna get a sticker. And they're very motivated with stickers, so they're gonna try to find the star very quickly. Okay, so instead of finding it over here, which is at the same place, top to top, middle to middle, bottom to bottom, the 3 year olds and the 4 year olds, and even the 5 year olds that we tested in this study, they will actually go for here because they're attracted by this matching of a pizza picture and a pizza picture. And then you probably ask me, why did you make it this way? Well, we made it purposefully because we want to see, can they overcome this object matching, simple matching by object into relational and look at the relations. Okay. So they go for this one, and they never find the stickers, and they are frustrated, and we knew this a lot of times. And so then another study, what we did is we used the same task, but we actually put language over here. But not all languages are the same. Not all set of words are the same. And here are the two set of words that we're using. One is a systematic set of words, and the other one is a non-systematic ones. So we call this here, this is called the first room number 1, and this is called room number 2. This is called room number 3. Half of the children heard that. The other half of the children heard, this is room, the dog's room. This is the pig's room. This is the sheep's room. And we tested their memory. Which one is the dog's room? This one. They're very good at this, okay? And what's really fascinating here is that this set of terms is monotone. It has a system. If you know where 1 is, you can infer where 2 is. If you know where 2 is, you can infer where 3 is. There's a monotonic change in height, and there's a systematic structure of language. It is abstract, however, and it's learned rather late. In contrast, these set of words are something that children are very familiar with. It's very concrete. You know what dog is, you know what pig is, you know what sheep is, and they really like things calling a dog's room, pig's room, sheep's room. Okay? They're familiar and appealing, and they are concrete. Okay? So these are two sets of words, and we want to know whether the systematic nature of this set of words, even though it's less appealing, more abstract, does that invite a systematic structure in the mind as well, such that they can do the task correctly? And the answer is yes. Even though they have the same memory about which room is called the pig's room and which room is called the third room, they only do well when they hear this number of words. Room number 1, room number 2, room number 3. Some of the children even go out and they say, oh, we call that drawer number 1, number 2, and number 3. So they really enjoy doing this, and they proceed it. This is probably the reason, if you're a New Yorker, you actually are very proud of of how your city is very logical, because you can find out where exactly 61st Street in contrast in 60th Street. But if you're from Boston, you have had people like saying how Boston is so chaotic because there's no system in how the and how the roads are arranged. The words, it's not systematic. The labeling is not systematic, right? You have Mass Ave, you have all kinds of like Harvard Ave, and you don't, but you don't know the relations between Harvard Ave and Mass Ave. In New York, that's much easier. You know the relations between 60th Street and 61st Street. Easier to find your way. Okay. That just to illustrate, it's not only for very young children that the systematic structure of the language can also invite systematic representations in the mind. Okay. So with and without words, there's definitely a mind without language. And what's really exciting development in the field is that we have the empirical tools to find out about this mind very precisely. What is it in the mind? What is known and what is not known? And with that, we can have a more precise predictions about what does language do to augment your thinking. In particular here, what does language do to augment your relational thinking? I offer three very precise roles of what exactly language does. Language can give you, naming can give you stability and accessibility so that you remember it better, you can carry it around better, you can tell other people better, you can make inference better. Common labels can invite comparison and abstraction, so you can get a new abstractions of knowledge. The structure of language also invites conceptual structures. And we come back to the very first question that we asked, that it's not only communication, but it's about symbolic system. And you notice that by naming, I am making use of the property, of the symbolic property of the language. And for these two, inviting comparison and abstractions and inviting conceptual structure, I'm making use of language as a symbolic system. So these are some of the things that we know. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention. As Erin has said, we always need your support. We need a lot of children. It's not easy to get children participants. So if you have children ages 2 to 7 years old, join us at the Kid Lab. There's a very easy way for you to actually join us. You can just sign up in our website. So if you go to kidlab.swarthmore.edu, you can right away click sign up, and we have a very easy system where we call you. And we do the studies based on your availability.